Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Welcome to another episode of Missing Frames. This is the podcast where we watch all the movies we should have seen by this point in our lives. I'm your host, Sean Eastridge. Joining me once again in the hot seat is Mr. John Mills. John, welcome back to the show.
I'm amazed because it's not a sequel.
So. I was going to say, this is the first in a long time that we've gotten to start with just a single movie that's not a sequel.
I'm a little disoriented, to be honest with you. This is weird for me. Actually, yeah, I think this is the first time non-sequel since Before Sunrise.
Yeah, no joke. I think you might be right.
Yeah, the Before trilogy, the sequels there and everything like that. So yay, hooray!
This is perfect. So we're starting over. And sadly, there are no sequels to this movie. And maybe there should be. Maybe I'm happy there aren't. But regardless, I'm just excited that you get to see this. This is Brad Bird's feature debut, The Iron Giant. And I absolutely love this movie. I'm a big Brad Bird fan. So this was, I didn't see it when it came out in theaters. I was relatively young, and the marketing for the film was terrible. I remember they had like Rock You Like a Hurricane in the trailers, and you couldn't quite figure out. It was that combined with the fact that it was an original property. You couldn't get a feel for what they were going for tone-wise, and it was animated. And I was getting to an age where I was like, animation is lame. I want to see real-life movies. But I missed it when it was
computer animation in the action sequences.
Exactly. Yeah. So I missed it when it was in theaters, and it's a shame because it wasn't a box office hit. It was a cult classic for a while, and it took a bit for Brad Bird to kind of get back on his feet, and then he ended up doing The Incredibles, and we have The Incredibles 2 coming out, so I figured why not go back and watch this, because you've never seen it.
No, amazingly, I haven't. I've heard reference to it constantly. I understood that it's there, and it's definitely one of those ones that just sat in the back of the mind where it's like, oh, I should get around to that someday, and you just, you keep saying, I should get around to that someday, I should get around to that someday.
Right.
And, of course, Ready Player One, in its free liberties that it took with the source material, decides instead of using, like Transor Z and stuff, or Gundam or anything like that, it's like, oh, kids know the Iron Giant, so we'll put that in there.
That's what one of my friends, my good friend Matt, he said, is the Iron Giant something people care about? Like, he said someone next to him freaked out when the Iron Giant appeared. Like, oh my God, it's the Iron Giant. And he's like, I didn't realize that was a thing.
Yeah. Yeah, I knew that it was there. Like, it was a reference that I got. And I think, seriously, I am so out of it in terms of, any details about the film. Isn't the voice of the Iron Giant, isn't that Vin Diesel?
It is, okay. Yeah.
Okay, so it is Vin Diesel. So it's got that going for it already, because I'm a big Vin Diesel fan.
Right, so, and he gets more to say than I am Groot in this movie. He
always a plus.
It's never I am Iron Giant. He actually gets a little bit more to say.
Oh, well, I certainly hope that at some point he mentions family, because that's what my favorite franchise with him does.
Absolutely. Speaking of another episode with sequels in it that we did.
Yeah, there you go.
But we, I saw this movie. I'm trying to remember when I first saw it. I don't know what motivated me to watch it. I think I'd seen The Incredibles by that point, and I was like, man, I love that movie. And it really is. It's one of my favorite Pixar movies. I love what Brad Bird does. I love him as a filmmaker. Of course, he's gone on to do like Ratatouille. He did Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. And I wasn't a big fan of Tomorrowland, but I know you enjoyed it.
I enjoyed, but I haven't revisited. Know that my daughters liked it. Because I took them to go see it because, that was really at the front of the wave of the we need more female heroes in movies sort of thing. And so, everybody got caught up in it and it's like, oh, look, female hero. And it's like, oh, OK, I'll take you kids to go see it. And I thought Tomorrowland was cool. And I had a good time watching it, but I haven't gone back to it since. Like there, right. Although I still remember clearly. I mean, I think Brad Bird has a really solid gift for creating set pieces that are memorable. Like the attack on George Clooney's house, I can still remember that very clearly.
Yes.
And I can still remember, you know, stuff from The Incredibles. And I can still, Ghost Protocol, good grief. That scene on the Burj Dubai. And even the fight in the parking garage at the end, that's a real testament to somebody who has a really good command of, you know, like spatial relationships and how to represent them on film. So, you know, it's kind of exciting to go back and see sort of like an origin point for him, because this is his first film, isn't it?
This is. I'm almost positive. I'm not even going to look it up because I'm almost 100% sure it is. This was his feature debut, and it's such a confident debut. And I feel like some people like me at that age are very dismissive of, like, oh, it's animated, who cares? Especially because it's 2D animation. It's not Pixar. Even though he would go on to do Pixar, I think a lot of people were very dismissive of animation at the time. We were starting to move into the world of Pixar where people wanted computer generated, and movies like this kind of fell under the radar. It wasn't like zippy with like fun humor like Toy Story. It was just a great animated movie with great characters, heartfelt emotion, and a wonderful story. It's got like that whole kind of vibe to it where it's like I want to say it takes place in the 50s, like late 50s. So it's got this kind of classic vibe to it. It's very much of that time, and I love that. I love it. Brad Bird kind of plays with that style, with the characters, with the settings, with the design of the robot, that kind of space age mentality of like, oh, it's Sputnik and what's going on and all that stuff. He plays with that brilliantly. It's all subtext in the film, but it's been a while since I've seen it. Like a lot of this stuff, I'm excited to watch it again because my last viewing, I really fell in love with it all over again. And it's going to be great to go back to watch it before seeing Incredibles 2, which I hope is good. But I don't know.
Not particularly optimistic about Incredibles 2, just because it's been, I made reference to this, when, you know, in a nerd party back and forth, with, you know, Disney's slate got revealed. And one of the things is like Frozen 2. And I'm kind of like, really? It's been a long time, guys. Like even my middle child who loved Frozen, I got, you know, listened to Let It Go thousands of times. It blared from our windows constantly. It played at birthday parties. I could sing along with it because I knew every single word to it. Even she recently said to both me and the missus, basically, you can back off of the Frozen stuff now. I'm kind of past it. And
wow.
Yeah, and it's like, so if you wait that long, and Incredibles, I remember The Incredibles was clever. I thought it was cute. Frozone was my favorite. But, you know, then to wait this long, I mean, I remember how long ago it was. It's kind of like, guys.
I really love, Incredibles is like top three Pixar for me. I mean, I love that movie, and I think it's a better Fantastic Four movie than any Fantastic Four movie, which really isn't that hard to do, to be honest.
Yeah,
but to be real, I think Brad Bird planted the flag early and extremely well. And Incredibles 2, I think people joked about it, but I think it's true. I think it's almost his kind of apology to Disney, because Tomorrowland did not do well at the box office. It didn't do well critically. And there's kind of a feeling that he was like, okay, guys, let me do Tomorrowland, my original work, and I'll pay you back with like Incredibles 2. That's what concerns me about it. And, but I have hope. I really want Brad Bird. I want the Brad Bird of it's unfair to really knock him. Tomorrowland is for me his only misstep. And other than that, you have what I would call three masterpieces of their genres. I think Incredibles is fantastic. It's a great superhero movie. I think Iron Giant is an incredible coming of age. It's got a strong E.T. vibe to it. And he does such a great job of imbuing each moment with humor, with heart. Even like he managed to do that with Mission Impossible. And I have hopes for Incredibles 2, but you're going to see a lot of his love for storytelling in The Iron Giant. I feel like first and foremost, he's just a great storyteller.
Do you think that it's possible that it's just that his best medium is animation? That he should, well, which isn't a knock. Like, everybody has a natural sort of area where they're best at, you know?
Yeah.
Like, Jim Kirk was never meant to be an admiral. He was always supposed to be a captain. You know, be satisfied with that. Like, this is what you're best at.
I would agree, except for the fact that Ghost Protocol was so fantastic and such a great, like you said, his ability to translate his visual sensibilities and his amazing sense of, like, setting, of character, of where to place a camera for the most effective joke or action and things like that, it translated so perfectly in a Ghost Protocol. And it's going to be fun to go back to Iron Giant and kind of watch and see, because, like I said, it's been a long time since I've seen this. I want to see how much of it is on display in Iron Giant. I remember it's extremely effective. Like I said, I love this movie. But it'll be fun to see, like, has there been growth? And then going to see Incredibles 2 to kind of watch his first movie, compare it to his most recent movie, see how has he changed? How are things getting better? Or is he kind of, I don't know. I don't want to say over the hill because I love the guy. I sincerely hope that you're as affected by this movie as I am. But what are your kind of feelings going into it? Like, where do you stand?
I just hope to enjoy it. Honestly, I just, it's something where, again, I'm familiar with the reference. I understand there are people who've really liked it. And so I'm hoping that I have one of those aha moments where I see it and I'm like, yeah, okay, I get it. You know, like, you always want that aha moment when you see something that everybody has really enjoyed. You don't want to come away with it saying, I don't get it. It's sort of like when you show The Godfather to somebody and their reaction is, it was okay.
Yeah.
And it's like, what didn't you see? What's going on? So, like, I always, I don't want to be that guy. So,
yeah. Well, there you go. Well, I'm going to try not to hype it up too much. I'm just going to cut us off here and let's go ahead and watch The Iron Giant.
Now available to own on video cassette.
Welcome back. We've just watched The Iron Giant, John Mills. What did you think?
What a charmingly little delightful film that I just watched. That was so adorably maddening that I didn't see it at the time, and that I waited this long to see it. It is so incredibly heartfelt, and the anime, I had not realized how long it's been since I've seen animation in that style either. That kind of blew my mind. But what an incredibly well paced and well constructed film. I can understand why it's so endeared.
Yeah, and it was fun to go back. It's been a long time since I've seen it, as I already mentioned, but it's wonderful to go back and rediscover why you loved a filmmaker in the first place. That's exactly how I felt watching this again. Is it's been a long time since I've watched a Brad Bird movie beyond just kind of Mission Impossible, which is great, but it's not really his thing. You know, he was hired by the company to do that, and he definitely gave it his aura of just visual flair and fun and excitement, and you see that inventiveness there. But to go back and see something that he'd made that was an expression of him and his heart is really charming. And it was fun to dive into kind of the behind the scenes features and learn a lot about this movie. And it's incredible to think that they made this at the time when, like I said, 2D animation was kind of, it had been revitalized a little bit. Warner Brothers had started up their own division after Lion King was such a huge hit, and all of a sudden everyone was like, we need animation. And their first feature, Quest for Camelot. Did you ever see Quest for Camelot?
No, I have a very vague recollection of it, though. But I never saw it, but I remember ads for it at least.
Yeah, I don't have a strong memory of it. I remember probably catching it on television, but that came out and it was a huge bomb. And a lot of why The Iron Giant ended up suffering at the box office was a result of that. Warner Brothers freaking out, and basically their budget was more limited and they had way less time than a lot of the other studios did, like Disney. They had a fraction of the budget and a fraction of the schedule to make a movie. Something like Tarzan, that was released at a similar time, had, I think, an extra year to do their production.
Yeah.
And the benefit of that was full creative control, which was kind of unprecedented at the time. So Brad Bird was really able to go in and thematically do what he wanted to do without much studio interference, which does, I mean, it doesn't really happen that often.
What's very interesting is looking at it, having seen Tomorrowland, which is, you know, also Brad Bird, and seeing there are certain visual, you know, trademarks that he has, but also a very strong affinity for that time period. Even when it's not set in that time period, it very much informs his work.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I was reminded of watching it was sort of the same thing that I came out of Tomorrowland with, which was, I'd have been so interested to see him do a Star Wars episode.
I know.
I would have. He's from that same mindset. This is the time period that shaped me. This is how I feel about it. He's in love with the same things that George Lucas was in love with. He's not in love with George Lucas and doing something that's, you know, what.
Or maybe he is in love with George Lucas. I mean, well, maybe there's, you know, something there that they need to address with each other.
Yeah, but
maybe that's why he didn't get a job on Star Wars. Maybe that's still a touchy subject for both of them.
But you know what I'm saying? Like, Force Awakens, yeah. You know, this is a very fair criticism of, like, it's just J.J. Abrams writing a love letter to George Lucas and Steven Spielberg.
Right.
Whereas I think,
which is
Brad,
a lot of, you could say that describes a lot of Abrams' career.
Yes. Well, especially
really.
Spielberg.
But, yes.
Yeah, he gave Lucas some attention in The Force Awakens. But the I think if Brad Bird had come in, you would have seen somebody who was more of a descendant of the actual things that shaped Lucas. That would have, I think it would have been a more interesting result, honestly. I mean, it's so easy to turn around and, I think, look at the earlier works of a filmmaker and then say, oh, well, their later stuff isn't so great. But tomorrow, like, I see the same spark that I see here in The Iron Giant in Tomorrowland. And it just killed me that it didn't, that one didn't spark with audiences.
Yeah, it's a similar situation where, yeah. I mean, Iron Giant, obviously Iron Giant has kind of been hailed as a animated classic, which Tomorrowland was not, and it still hasn't, and I haven't gone back and rewatched it, I haven't had a lot of interest in it, but the love and the passion you're describing is there, and the same vibe is there. And it makes me sad because Brad Bird is, I remember when they were looking for directors for Episode 7, and I kept saying, Brad Bird, top of my list. I think he could do a great job. And at the time, he'd done The Incredibles, and his only live action had been Mission Impossible. But I was like, I think he's got the flair. Based on this, you're absolutely right. It's a lot of the same influences, the same kind of upbringing, and the same love, but the same same interest in heartfelt storytelling that drove kind of George Lucas's original Star Wars and trying to do that. And I was so bummed, like you said, and it sucks because it feels like with Iron Giant, he had the validation. Even though the movie bombed when it came out, he is now, like, people have since said, like, oh, it's a classic, it's amazing, and he's gotten that validation, but he hasn't gotten it with Tomorrowland, which is kind of sad, because to him, that's just as personal a project.
Yeah, you know, it's very fun, and I guess to stay sort of topical, it's very fun to look back at a film like Iron Giant and realize that there were likely people there that came out of the theater saying, this is wonderful, you should go see it, this is magnificent, but it didn't get a warm reception at the time. And it took time for people to turn back and say, you know, we should have given this more of a chance. We should have been in love with what he did here and those sorts of things. There are so many examples of that through time. Mm. And it's just even more maddening because of everybody is still obsessed with box office, box office, box office, you know, and it's always used as the validation of an argument about a film, but you know, like you said, people came around to this, and it's
yeah.
I just wish there was more of an atmosphere of I don't know, just sort of like a genuine willingness to let the sins of a previous effort, you know you talk about the you know, the Camelot film and this sort of suffering for it. It's so maddening because it is a production schedule for all of these films where there is a domino effect. If there's any bad vibe left from the previous effort, the next one suffers no matter how good the next one is. And it's just, it's really, it's a shame. I mean, I can't believe that this isn't something that did, you know, record-breaking box office at the time.
Right. It's true. And they were, and a lot of it had to do with the marketing at the time. Warner Brothers was very, I don't think they knew what they had, really. That seems to be reflected in what everyone was saying, is there was this Iron Giant movie, an original property that was being made kind of without a lot of studio input. They originally had a, it's based on a children's book called The Iron Man by Ted Hughes. And what's fascinating about that is Ted Hughes was married to Sylvia Plath, who wrote The Bell Jar.
Wow.
I've just read The Bell Jar for the first time, and I absolutely loved it. And Ted Hughes wrote this book for his children as a way to help them cope with their mother's death when she committed suicide. And it was so fascinating. But, you know, the whole idea of, like, how does one put oneself back together again? How do you put the pieces back together when something horrible happens? A metaphor that's played out like literally in the movie, the robot puts itself back together. But they had this script that was going to be a musical at first, kind of in the vein of what a lot of these movies were doing at the time. And Pete Townsend from The Who was attached to do the music. And he's actually an executive producer. That's what made me look it up, because he's listed as an executive producer. I was like, is it that Pete Townsend?
I just saw the credits and it didn't even occur to me. I just chalked it up as same name. You know,
Pete,
like,
Townsend.
Yeah. Okay. Sure.
There's so many Townsends out there.
Yeah. You know,
so like, many Petes.
Yeah. But I mean, like, if you saw somebody in the credits, you know, as a producer, that was like, I can't pull a name, like Michael Keaton or something like that.
Right.
It's like, is it really?
Is that Michael Keaton?
Huh,
yeah.
Okay.
So it was funny. This kind of. Oh, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, it's funny you mentioned the ending, you know, putting yourself back together and everything, because in the modern era, zero doubt in my mind that film ends, credits roll, and then at the end, you see the screw roll off and then
right.
go to the giant in
yeah,
Iceland.
We're so accustomed now to the post credits, not getting the full movie going experience. You have to wait till the end of the credits to get the rest of the movie.
Oh yeah. No, I just watched Lego Batman with the kids, and they're now, you know, I'm like, okay, movie's over. And the oldest just goes, but what about, I was like, no, not everything has a post credit scene. Just keep moving. We saw Solo in the theater. Why are we leaving? I know there's no post credit scene is why.
Right.
Come on, let's just go.
It's a lost art now.
Yeah.
But,
people are just conditioned. It's like, you know, just do it like TV shows now and have the credits rolling over like the last 5 minutes of the film or something like that. Like,
right.
you know, just have it like a sitcom.
Yeah.
You know, why not?
Let's do it. But yeah. So Warner Brothers had it and it had been bouncing around a lot. And Brad Bird finally kind of had gotten a hold of it. And he repitched it as the whole Atomic Age thing, where it's like, it's America during the 1950s. And here's what I think we should do. And he kind of gave them a very strong pitch that I think kind of terrified them. But also they were like, this sounds awesome. But the result was the movie never had the support it needed from Warner Brothers. They did their due diligence by saying, we trust you to make the movie and we'll check in to make sure you're actually making a movie and not just fooling around. But the problem was, when the movie, they didn't market it because they had no clue what they had or how special it was. And it wasn't until they screened it to audiences, like did a test screening, and it received the best screening scores Warner Brothers had had in 15 years. Like, it was, and Warner Brothers was finally like, oh, we should market this movie, huh? I guess we should. So with 4 months left, not a single poster or trailer or like action figure tie-in, they create and I talked about it a little bit in the first part of the show, but some of the worst advertising I've ever seen. All this kind of stuff with emphasis on, like, you know, heavy metal has a new face, and it's like a giant robot and like rock music, the Iron Giant. And Brad Bird's like, oh my God, what are they doing? But it's no surprise that the movie crashed and burned, because I remember seeing those commercials as a kid and thinking, like, not only do I not care about animation, but this looks weird. What is this? What is this? Is it supposed to be like funny? Is it supposed to be? I don't know, but you see how crucial marketing is to a film and how it can play a huge part in the success or failure of it. And in this case, it was shockingly bad. It's gone down in infamy as one of the worst marketing strategies and campaigns for any film.
Yeah, and yet those marketing campaigns continue where you go to a movie and you're like, wait, what? This isn't anything like the ad. Yeah,
Now we have the benefit of the internet. Like, this movie came out in 1999, where it's like, regardless of a bad marketing campaign, and the one that comes to mind, like, it's also kind of a family-oriented movie, is Paddington. Paddington, I think, has some of the worst U.S. marketing I've ever seen. If Rotten Tomatoes hadn't existed back when, if Paddington had been released in 1998, Rotten Tomatoes didn't exist, we didn't know, it was like, it's on 98 and people love it. I don't think it would have had much success at all. And it didn't do great over here, but it did enough to kind of merit a second one.
Yeah.
And had a good worldwide gross. But you see how the internet plays a part in that now. Like, I don't know. Do you think, like, a movie like The Iron Giant would have failed? I know Ain't It Cool News got an early... They sent an early screening. One of the animators leaked an early version of the film to Ain't It Cool because no one was marketing the film and they wanted to get some buzz generated. And Ain't It Cool gave it a rave review that kind of boosted everyone. It made them feel like, oh, maybe we do have something special here. But do you think, like, if it was more pronounced, do you think this movie could have had a little bit more of a life in it?
Well, yes, but at the same time, one of the things that's most charming about this film is the fact that it doesn't seem to belong to the modern era. There's a lot of cynicism. I mean, you bring up the internet age and everything like that. And hey, guess what? There's a film coming out and it's all sweet and loving. And, you know, people are falling all over themselves for the punchline. People are falling all over themselves to be cynical about it. And so do I think it would have made too big a difference? Not really. I don't. Mm-hmm. I think that this is the sort of thing that would need tremendous word of mouth. Do I think the internet would help it? No. The internet's just a big tower of Babel with, you know, endless echoes and everything like that. So, you know, I would like to think that, but at the end of the day, I mean, it's so difficult even to imagine an era where something like this would be released without some sort of, you know, some sort of major push for a connected universe or something like that. You know,
yeah, there's no, it's an original property. I mean, it's based on a book, but it's not like it's a well-known book.
Right.
It's not. Yeah. Where's the sequel? What can we tie it into? They have some nice little connections to Superman, but it's very driven not so much by like Superman as much as the, oh, it's the comics, that's what people were reading at the time, and that's very much the mindset. Superman is the classic American comic book hero.
Yeah.
So in that way, it's true. I mean, it's a good point. The movie does not feel beholden to any one era. It honestly feels like, 2D animation obviously isn't happening anymore, but it does feel like it could have been made almost at any point, other than, you know, the giant himself obviously has some computer generated trickery to give him that sort of lumbering feel, but thematically, story wise it does feel like that kind of is why it works so well to me. I think part of the reason the movie succeeds is because it's a nostalgic love letter to that era, but it feels very much of its time, and it deals with a lot of themes and issues that I think are relevant, because it's life and death, it's choosing who you want to be, it's how we overcome our upbringing, or whatever our shortcomings might be, to find what we truly want and what we can be capable of.
Yeah, I mean, it's in essence, a little call to action to be mindful of who you are and where you're going. And that's definitely timeless. I think that having it be in that era gives people more of an, like, if you, it's so weird. I'm very much of the opinion that when you set something in an era that's too close to the modern one, people just have a default disconnect for too wholesome a message. It's like you have to set a wholesome message in the past because people refuse to believe. Maybe that's what we're missing, is we need to have like a John Hughes who's like, okay, it's 2018. Let's have a good message set now.
Right.
Let's show people behaving well now.
I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that that was, a lot of people see it, and I didn't live through it. You didn't live through it, but like a lot of people see the 50s as the final, like that was the end of innocence for America, because then you had JFK and then Vietnam and all this stuff kind of coming in. So there is an idealistic sort of, those were the good old days when there was, you could trust, quote unquote, the government. You could trust, you could go outside and not be afraid. There was the possibility of space travel and that optimism. This movie deals very heavily with the atomic age, the fact that, we could get blown up. And I loved the the duck and cover video they show classroom that was being shown all over. But, but there is that level of optimism to the decade that I think naturally makes filmmakers want to go and say it was a more innocent time, because it kind of was a more innocent time.
Well, it was a time where people weren't so connected. And so there's very much that, where it's, you go back to an era when people weren't so connected or in each other's business. You got to go back pretty far.
Yeah.
To really be reminded of how much room for contemplation there was before reaction.
Sure.
Right? Like, let's take the fact that the kid says, no, people can't see you because of how they'll react. And we don't want them being afraid of you. They're not ready for you yet. And so, Iron Giant shows up and he saves those kids. And, it's the first real visual appearance to the town. And, you move that forward to the modern age and people are taking pictures with their phones. I can't believe there's a giant robot. He's going to kill us. How can we trust him? Whereas back then.
Yeah,
it's like,
it can't be what it is. It's right. Not, you're interpreting it through someone else's experience or
right.
Someone else's filter.
Exactly.
And you lose, I think it's true. It's a lot of what we've lost is the ability to judge a situation for ourselves by experiencing it ourselves, as opposed to judging through someone else's filter of what that situation or experience
exactly.
is. That's a really interesting point of view on it. I love all the that feel of paranoia. You have the government coming in, and you have the government agent played by Christopher McDonald, and he's great. I couldn't figure out I was like, I know this voice. And then when I finally realized, I was like, oh, of course it's him. But I love that kind of feeling of paranoia, that there is. The government kind of represents the loss of innocence that America is about to experience, and the step into that kind of age of scrutiny and skepticism and surveillance that was just on the border. And there's the terrifying scene where he's kind of cornered Hogarth and is like, yeah, I'll take you away from your mom and all this stuff. And mm-hmm. Hogarth is like, oh, you can't do that. And he's like, oh, we can. And it's scary because it's amazing they put that in the movie, because it is a terrifying thing for a kid to think about, like, oh, someone has more power over me than my parents do and has the power to overrule that. To a kid, that's a very scary thing, and it's pretty brave to put it in a family film. But it does kind of indicate that sort of, like, we're moving into that era, and it's the army and the military that kind of, their lack of ability to discern and to see the differences and to allow the differences and to stop and listen without just shooting first, that causes many of the problems
But I will say, at the same time, it's the military that, it's the general who is the good guy at the end.
Yeah.
Who said, it's this low-level bureaucrat who manipulates the system and puts false information into it that causes all of these problems.
Exactly. So I mean, exactly.
You know, welcome to Government Corner, where we're going to peel apart the bureaucratic machinations of the Iron Giant. But, you know, seriously, I mean, you know, that's I mean, E.T. has that same sort of cynicism about the government.
Yeah.
And I think that's, you know, when you go back and you see movies from that time period or movies that are set in that time period, I think the filmmakers consciously inject that idea of, hey, here was more innocence and we were happier and we were going around. But the government is that sort of like lurking snake in the background, you know, but I mean, whatever, you know, why go down that road?
Let's do it just for the Iron Giant. This is what it's all about.
Yeah, but, no, it's a whole interesting other
it is
topic,
but yeah. it is cool, and it's fun that this movie can kind of provoke those kinds of thoughts in this day and age that feel relevant, because the movie does feel relevant. But so as far as in terms of the movie winning you over, and in terms of connecting with it thematically or story wise were you pretty on board from the beginning? Was there a point that kind of won you over, or was it gradual?
No, I was pretty much on board from the beginning. I think that, you know, as a testament to Bird, it's just really well constructed, and it's really, you know, it's just engaging from the beginning, and it immediately sets up the time period, because you see Sputnik floating up above, and so you immediately know what's going on, and the ship crashing and all of that sort of stuff.
I love that. I love the visual. It's a bit, like I said, I've seen this movie enough to know I love it, but I love spacing out my viewings of my favorite movies, because I feel like it gives me a chance to forget the movie in a way. So things like the opening when he's like, oh, I see the lighthouse, and the head slowly turns, and it's like, that's not a lighthouse, it's a space station. I loved that. And it's such a... Bird has an incredible way of just these visual ideas, this visual flair that shows up in the movie time and time again. And there's a lot of striking imagery in this movie. I love the robot, the giant himself, is designed by Joe Johnston.
That explains why that robot is so wonderful.
It really is. It's like you just want... I want just I know they have a figure out there somewhere, like a really well-designed figure.
Now that I've seen this, I suddenly understand why the reference is in Ready Player One, even though it sort of like breaks the, you know, 1980s obsession of you know, blah, 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 the source material. But like, I suddenly get it now, where I'm like, oh, yeah, that... yes, you would put the Iron Giant in there. Yes, you
right,
would.
Exactly.
That makes sense.
Yeah, I watched the movie, and I'm like, of course, who wouldn't? Anyone who sees this movie wouldn't. You watch this movie, and you kind of have a passionate reaction to it. Like, you kind of are like, people aren't like, nah, that was okay. You know, it's like the Iron Giant typically provokes some very warm feelings. So to get that in Ready Player One, it wasn't too surprising to me. But it was, I do love the design of the robot. I love, you mentioned E.T. E.T.'s my favorite Spielberg movie, so I love that kind of vibe. I get a very strong E.T. vibe from this. But were there any other kind of influences you picked up on that kind of you recognized? Or
I mean, sure. I mean, like, it just even visually and everything. I mean, the thing that I really key in on is the fact that I think one of the reasons why I'm so keen on animation directors getting live action films is because I think that, you know, you look at something like this by Brad Bird, you can tell that it's a part of this craft that you have to be very conscious and very aware of each decision that you make. It forces you to plan, and especially in the era of, you know, computers will fix it in post sort of stuff. There, like, I understand now why Ghost Protocol has such a deliberate air about it, and why Tomorrowland has a very structured, deliberate, you know, storyline, is because of the fact that he thinks like this. I have to get everything set because of the way the production process works. It's sort of one of the things where, I was talking with somebody about, they should force modern effects people to go back to old film techniques, just as a, you know, as a warm up, to force them to be thoughtful about
yeah.
Well, how it is putting it's effects together.
because you have to, when in animation, the difference between that and film is film, you can go on a set and have storyboards and say, you know what, let's try something new, let's try something fun. But with animation, you can't do that. You're talking about, like, if you say I want to change this, that's months and months of
right.
like new drawings you have to make. Like it's an animation, the storyboards and the pre-animatics are the Bible, and it's the gospel truth. You can't alter it, you can't touch it. And I think that gives him a very strong ability to go in and say, here is what the strongest visual is going to be. Here's what's going to be the most effective. And you see it in The Iron Giant. I mean, this is his feature debut, and there's a lot of it is so beautifully constructed, as you were saying, so well told, very economical. It's a short movie, but you get a really rich thematic experience, a very emotional and engaging experience. But it is incredible to see how even this early in his career, and this is after The Simpsons. I mean, he'd been doing The Simpsons, which is also a very visually oriented yeah. show with a lot of visual gags, and you can kind of see the humor coming through, like the scene with Hogarth with the coffee and like being
yes.
so like
yeah.
being
so wired. Yeah,
exactly. You. The snappiness of The Simpsons, that quick, like the quick humor, the quick visual gags, you get that sensibility, but it's also met with this sort of visual poetry in a way. Like there are these really beautiful moments where he wasn't afraid to, just because of the medium, because of what people are used to in the medium, animation, especially with Disney, was very like fast and fun and zany and jokes and music and he's not afraid here to kind of go the Miyazaki route where it's like longer shots, slower pacing and at times, and just letting things kind of play out, like the scene with the deer, which is really beautiful and a really yeah. Heartbreaking moment and scene. But it's really
that would even be a callback to Bambi.
Yeah,
you know
it is. And just, I mean, it's not a knock against Disney, because I know he worked for Disney early on in his career, and that's what inspired him, that's what inspired so many animators. But there was You see that influence there, and you see that love of classic Disney before the animation got a little bit more almost OCD. They got afraid that kids weren't going to sit down and pay attention. And so it's right. like, how do we fill the screen with as much as possible and make it as fun and zany? It's refreshing to see kind of a filmmaker who's able to be confident enough to say, you know what? No, we're going to take a breather, we're going to let the scene play out, we're going to let it play, and we're going to address things like death, and we're going to address things like do machines have souls? Like, what does it mean to have a soul? What does it mean to be human? And things like that. Very mature stuff for a kid's movie. Mm-hmm. To be fair, I mean, we're talking a lot about the marketing being the main reason for this movie's downfall, but there's a lot of mature stuff in this movie that I'm not sure a general family audience would, I don't want to say they'd be uncomfortable, but there is a lot of deep stuff in this movie that takes it beyond just like general, like, oh, it's a fun weekend, fun night out at the movies.
Yeah, but that, you know, even that calls back to sort of the Disney stuff that had plenty of those messages and meanings. I think the kids are,
that's
kids
true.
Are plenty able to handle what you give them, you know, for the most part, so long as you know how to tell the story to them.
Like, that is
people
very
sometimes
true.
Don't give kids enough credit, basically. And
I know I don't.
Yeah.
Those little bastards.
Well, they're all outsmarting me by this point, so I've learned a new respect for my place in the hierarchy. Marge, beating your dad at something is an important milestone, in part achieved by the time he was 10.
But you're right. I mean, yeah. I remember going, it's funny you mentioned that, because I remember going back and watching The Lion King and being like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this was released as a family film. It's yeah. so intense at times. And
well,
very
look at Beauty and the Beast, for Pete's sake.
Beauty and the Beast, yeah. I mean, you know, you're absolutely right. It is funny that you mentioned that. I think sometimes I get a little too, because I've never been a big Disney fan, I get a little too condescending towards them, but they have... There's some dark stuff in their movies.
Well, I definitely think the animation style in this, I to my eye, and maybe it's just I'm not as in tune with Disney's 2D animation stuff anymore, but it very much seemed to be more of the Bluth offshoot school than just like the straight Disney influence. Mm-hmm. You know, Secret of Nim or An American Tale sort of feel to the animation.
Yeah.
rather than straight Disney, although there was a very conscious sort of like lack of shading on the characters unless it was necessary in the scene, which I thought was very, like the colors were very even and very much an emphasis on contour. And what was amazing actually was in a couple of the shots, I noticed that Hogarth, you could see the pencil strokes around his mouth and eyes. And it's like that was a shocking thing because it's like, wow, that's right. That used to be a thing.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't all a computer algorithm in front of me. And there was somebody who actually, their wrist was dodging along, you know, like making these frames. It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy.
It's insane to go back and watch something like that. And this is, you know, I mean, one of the last great 2D animated efforts. And it's a beautiful thing. I mean, I think sometimes we forget it's similar to how computer generated graphics kind of became like, that's so cool and everything needs that. And you kind of forgot the beauty of the practical, and eventually it kind of balanced out. And I wonder, do you think there will ever be a return to 2D animation? Like, do you think we'll see that have a chance to come back? I know Miyazaki does it, but it's like those movies don't necessarily count as big hits in America. But like, do you think there will ever be an opportunity for, in the same way practical effects of kind of, oh, we need everything to be practical and less focus on CG, do you think there will be a balance or a return of the 2D animation form?
Well, I know that Star Wars Resistance, that animation style is 2D form, obviously done with modern technology and everything. Do I see a large scale re-adoption of it? No, you'd need somebody who would be like a this will sound weird the way I'm going to state it, but like a Tarantino of animation. Somebody who comes back and is like, no, I want to get back to what it was like when I was growing up watching these things, you know, like, and
you know, it's funny. I did a Tarantino impression recently and it's funny how much he sounds like Woody Allen. It's like Woody Allen, Woody Allen was like, all my movies are violent, but just as into himself, just as, just as self-obsessed.
Well, I need a moment. Because I hadn't thought about that, but you're so absolutely right. It's absolutely right.
I literally had this realization today. I'm so glad I have an excuse to talk about it on this episode.
Well done. Well done.
But I do think you're right.
And I do want to say thank you to this film for, I guess, being the spark that really drove Vin Diesel forward. You know, in terms of his career.
Because, I mean, I think this is what got him the part on Guardians of the Galaxy. They're like, well, you can be a lumbering.
Well, I have to be reminded sometimes that Vin Diesel was in Saving Private Ryan.
He
was actually in Saving Private Ryan. It's like, what? I remember that was like the first time, because he was in a watch ad at the time. And I remember seeing a picture, and he was like sitting there doing, you know, like crazy Vin Diesel face with flexing his muscle, like, yeah. And he had like the watch on his arm. And I remember, it's so weird.
And you're like, that guy needs to play a giant robot.
It's just so weird because it's like burned in your brain this moment. And it's like, why? What got kicked out of my brain to hold on to this Vin Diesel watch ad? And I remember looking at it, and it's just, it's so funny because it's like, well, you know, maybe Iron Giant gave me the Fast and Furious movies, and for that alone, I should buy the signature edition.
You should be thankful.
Yes.
That's exactly right. The Iron Giant, I think there should be a connection made there. I think we can thank Brad Bird for, quote-unquote, discovering Vin Diesel. And
even
giving
if it's
us...
not true, we're going with that story.
Without Brad Bird, we wouldn't have this episode. We wouldn't have the Fast and Furious franchise episode, which everyone should listen to if you haven't already.
That's true.
So was there anything about the movie that didn't really work for you? Was there anything that held it back from maybe being great? Or
no, you know, I think that there is, you know, this is basically the why didn't you give it 5 stars question. And I would say that probably the fact that it is so focused on being very lean, I think that if they had decided to take 10 more minutes, they could have dwelled on a couple of emotional beats that would have given it a little more heft. But it's not, I don't consider it a sin. I consider the genre and the target audience, and they're not going for you know, they're not trying to make, you know, an adult man like be like, I should really question the role of the government in the Iron Giant. They're just making a straightforward film with a lesson and a moral that's clear to understand. And that's fine. And that's cool. Yeah. And so I wouldn't ding it too hard for that. But, you know, if I'm going to be nitpicky, that's what is there anything you would that jumped out at you this time?
No, you know, honestly, I love this movie, and I try really hard, especially when we're doing these episodes, to look at it with a critical eye and say, is there anything? And I do see that. I see what you're saying. Like, it does at times, it's like, man, this is a really short movie, but I don't really knock it for that. It's very economical in its storytelling, and it does, the simplicity is not an issue for me, and the length is not an issue for me, because I get enough of the emotional heft, and I get enough of the characters. I think I was just more impressed because I was trying to knock it. Like, I was trying to think of, like, okay, maybe I should come up with something to be critical about, and I couldn't find anything. And the length seemed to be the easiest thing to go after, but it's so, the way Bird and the voice actors establish these characters, and you get a very clear idea of who they are, what they want, and all that. So it was, there's not a lot I discredit this movie for. It's hard for me to be cynical or to turn a critical eye on it because I love it so much. But
so let me ask you a question, just like my one last remaining question for you, because I've spent so much time with Schindler, these sorts of brain questions pop up, and if you were doing a double feature, what would you pair the Iron Giant with?
That's a tough question. My immediate instinct is to say The Incredibles, because I think that obviously, you know, there's the connection to Brad Bird. But again, The Incredibles, Brad Bird has a love for that kind of what do you call that style? Is it Art Deco? Like that 50s style?
Yeah, yeah,
like,
Art Deco was big in the 50s. Yeah.
Yeah, it's got that is you find that in all his work. Mission Impossible is really the only exception because it's very modern. It's a spy thriller and it's all modern technology. But The Incredibles, I guess Ratatouille, not really. But Incredibles, Iron Giant, and Tomorrowland all really have those feelings. So what's great is, or that vibe, the Iron Giant is amazing and I love it. And it's a shame that it was a box office dud. But the reason I would say The Incredibles, beyond just the fact that it's directed by him, is to see him have the tools that Pixar provides to tell his story without fear once again. Like, it's great to see that evolution. Incredibles feels like a very natural evolution for him as a filmmaker. And that's a movie I'm excited to watch again. You know, Incredibles 2 is coming out very soon. We're only, I think, a couple weeks away at the time of this episode's release. And I'm hoping for the best. You know, I try not to be cynical. I'm worried because it's been a long time since that movie came out. But I'm excited to watch the first one again, especially after watching The Iron Giant going back. And then there's a little bit of The Rocketeer in there. Maybe Ooh. That's because I'm thinking of Joe Johnston, and it's a similar kind of vibe, similar kind of style and fun. And some Max Fleischer Superman cartoons, the Metal Man,
yeah,
the Mechanical Monster ones specifically.
Well, that could be your in between.
The between takes.
Yeah, you're well. No, I mean, like, you're in your double feature. You could have those. You know, one or two of those, the Max Fleischer cartoons.
So you're saying I shouldn't do a between takes episode? You don't think the world needs more of me?
No, I think you should do a between takes episode, but I already know the one that's coming up that I'm not allowed to talk about yet. So
it'll be great.
It will be. What I would do as it's very strange. If I were going to do a Brad Bird double feature, I would actually show Tomorrowland because I think that I wasn't nuts about Tomorrowland. I didn't love Tomorrowland, but I do think it's a film that didn't get enough attention, that deserved a little bit more attention. So I would love to take Iron Giant and Tomorrowland and just have it be like the double feature of, you know, unrecognized work from a great artist.
Mm.
But then another part of me, and I don't know if it's because it's Warner Brothers Animation or not, but the similar, you know, design aesthetic and stuff like that, I might pair this up, especially because both of them feature snow, with Batman Mask of the Phantasm.
Yeah. Oh man,
that'd be a pretty great double feature, I think.
Yeah, and another I forgot. I mean, Warner Brothers they were really rocking the animation. It's a shame that they felt so paranoid about this movie and whether or not it would do well, and that their features didn't do great. Because creatively, what an amazing team! And those Superman and Batman, those animated series are incredible. And Mask of the Phantasm is, yeah. I see that.
I think that would be a pretty great double feature, and but the thing is, it continues to this day if you really think about it, because Warner Brothers, the whole boring thing people keep beating up on, the Zack Snyder films, blah 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 blah. But like, their animated stuff is still pretty darn strong.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you ask somebody about the Warner Brothers animated superhero stuff, they're always like, oh yeah, that's really good. I like that.
Right.
It's weird. It's whoever's been running the animation side really maybe should be brought in to consult on their live action side from time to time. Just have an exchange of ideas here.
That's a freebie, Warner Brothers.
Yeah.
Take it or leave it.
Yeah. I sit in my well-appointed office with all of my movie memorabilia, which proves I know what I'm talking about.
Right. That's why I have you on the show. I need someone who knows what they're talking about. Right. Yeah. So I guess final ratings. Man, what should our rating scale be for this movie?
Junkyards.
How many junkyards? How many junk art sculptures? Yeah. How many Harry Connick Jr. junk art sculptures would you give the Iron Giant on a scale from 1 to 5?
4.5. I would give
it four
full ones and one half chewed one. So there you go.
Perfect. I'd give it the perfect 5. I, like I said, I was trying to find an excuse to knock it, and I couldn't. I really adore this movie, and it's a special film, and I really hope Tomorrowland, I feel like, through Brad Bird for a loop, we haven't heard from him in a while, and Incredibles 2 is a movie he's been talking about for years and years, but I'm nervous because I don't know if it's necessarily a movie he wants to make. And I want to see him come back and make something he really wants to make. And I hope it's good, and I'm hoping for the best, because watching this movie reminded me just how special a filmmaker he is. And it's great, and I'm glad we got to watch it and get a chance to talk about it before Incredibles 2 comes out.
Yeah, thanks, man. I really appreciate you being the driving force to get me to watch it. So that's pretty awesome.
Of course. And I always appreciate whenever I can be recognized as the reason for anything in your life.
You're the reason for so many things. This is one of the rare positive ones. So there you go.
So, John, if people want to find you here on the Nerd Party Network or elsewhere, where can they find you on the internet?
Oh, well, I'm hanging out in the junkyard known as Twitter with my nom de plume, Kessel Junkie. You can also find me out there in the ether co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig. And you can find me here on the network co-hosting on Aggressive Negotiations, a Star Wars podcast with Matthew Rushing, and Great Shot Kid, a film podcast with Mike Schindler.
That is beautiful. I will go find you in all those places, and I will quickly get a restraining order and I'll hold them. I'm on Twitter at @YayShondorman. Of course, you can check out the Nerd Party. We're on Facebook and Twitter. Twitter is Join Nerd Party, and Facebook is just the Nerd Party. And check out all the other great shows on there. John's shows are great, and we've got a lot of cool stuff there. If you like what you're hearing on iTunes, feel free to give us a 5-star rating. And wherever else, I don't know how other rating systems work, but do that wherever as well.
Sounds
and great. And on that note, let's just sign off and say, go watch The Iron Giant.